So it's the February 18th Board of Health meeting. We do not have a quorum, so we will not be able to approve the agenda. We'll not be able to call it really a Board of Health meeting. We'll call it a gathering of people who care about the health of the community. I'm going to go with that. And we're not going to be able to approve the regular session minutes, but those are not deal breaker issues. We will, however, be able to hear the presentations, and Commissioner Bacon and I would like to be able to take advantage of that. I think Commissioner Sinclair is listening online, but she can't communicate in order to vote. So the things we're holding up, I don't think are significant enough. So we'll just keep moving and hear the presentations, and then everybody listening can then hear the presentations and gather the information if that works for you. Okay.
And Janet was just admitted.
Oh.
And so let's do post the this afterwards, even if it ends up not being a real Board of Health meeting.
Okay.
Because we do have a quorum of the commissioners.
Well, if we have a quorum, we can just call the meeting to order. That what works to call the meeting to order. So now we have a real meeting. Thank you, Janet. And then of note, Commissioner Sinclair's online. Commissioner Bacon and I are both here. Commissioner Wallen from the hospital is not here, and the mayor of Oak Harbor is not here. And our Navy representative isn't here. But Celine, are you the Navy today?
No, I am not. I'm not able to be here. Right now.
Okay. I like to put Celine in charge of things, though. Because
Yeah.
then we're in good hands. Because then we're in good hands. All right. So that's our group.
Commissioner, I want to point out.
Just want to make sure.
Yeah, Janet tried to talk.
Yeah. Commissioner St. Clair, can you try speaking? Unmute your mic.
All right. Can you hear me?
Okay.
We hear you today
All
now.
right. Well, then, can we have a motion to approve the agenda as presented?
So moved.
A second.
We have a motion, a second, to approve the agenda as amended or presented. Is there any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries unanimously.
I move to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
We have a motion, a second, to approve the minutes from January 21st. Is there any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 That concluded our official business. Is there anybody here for public input or comment? Anybody online? Anyone in the room? We'll close the public comment period. Our first presentation is environmental health and water availability. I will give you a dollar for every time you say sole source aquifer. Properly.
Properly. Use it properly.
Just kidding. I might go broke. And Chris Kelly, our hydrologist, is here. And is Emily coming up? Emily, it says you. She said no.
Let me share the correct screen. All right. So, yes, I'm here today. Thank you for having me to talk about water availability in Island County. And so, real quick, kind of right off the bat, I want to stress that we're discussing specifically drinking water availability. And so, when we talk about drinking water, in the terms of how the state looks at water, we have resources of water. So groundwater, surface water would be the resource of water. And then we have beneficial uses of water. So it could be a drinking water, potable water, beneficial use. It could be an industrial use. It could be an agricultural use. Those would be the assigned beneficial uses. And when we look at drinking water, it really breaks down to we have private well systems that are serving typically one household. And then we have community systems that could be serving two to thousands, if not millions of people on a single community system. So when we look at the drinking water and those roles and responsibilities, It starts with the resource and how we allocate the resource. And in Washington, the resource is allocated by ecology with a water right. And so that water right is going to say, you can use this volume of water for this specific beneficial use. You're going to take the water from this location and you're going to use it over this area. So in terms of a town like, let's say, the town of Coopville, they have a water right that says that they can withdraw from their wells a set volume of water and that they can use that water over their service area. So if they wanted to all of a sudden say, hey, we're going to expand and we want to connect down to Green Bank, we're going to run a pipeline all the way down 20 and connect to the Green Bank area, they'd have to not only go through to expand their service area, they'd actually have to alter their water right with ecology to say that they can expand where they're using that water. And then for when we look at water systems, for those large water systems, those group A systems serving 15 or more connections, they have a water right from ecology, and then they have to go through the Department of Health to do any water quality requirements and water system design requirements. So that's going to be where they say you have to meet these standards set forth in the Safe Drinking Water Act, and you have to be able to provide this volume of water per customer. So that way you can assume that if every household on the system is designed to wash a load of laundry at the exact same time, you're not going to get a drop in water pressure. For those smaller systems, so the group Bs, the two parties and the individual wells, they're going to have to meet Island County code requirements. And for the group B components, we've adopted, the county has adopted the minimum design standards set forth by the state of Washington. And so it's very similar to the group A systems, just kind of scaled down of, you know, because for the group B systems, they're not going to have as stringent testing requirements. They're not going to have to consider components like fire suppression, so fire hydrants, things like that, that a group A water system would have to consider and then design a system to meet those needs as well.
Group B doesn't have to meet fire flow standards, or they have different fire flow standards?
They're not going to have fire hydrants.
Got it. And aren't most of our people on group Bs?
I give a breakdown on a future slide, but there's more group Bs and two-party systems, but if you look at population served, it's heavily weighted towards group As. And then the water system themselves also have responsibilities that are established under Washington state law. And it's things like they have to provide the drinking water, quality water under proper pressure at all times. They have to do the routine monitoring, all of those kind of things. And the same thing for individual well owners. So if, you know, for example, my well is on an individual well, if I decided that I wanted to have my water tested because I was concerned about arsenic, I have to do that myself. There's no state agency or county agency that's going to do that. So when we start looking at drinking water availability, what it really comes down to is the infrastructure. And especially when working with the planning department on the comp plan stuff, it really comes down to, well, what water resources, what is already available? And so we start looking at those group A's and those group B public water systems. And so when we look at those systems, it's not just about pulling water out of the aquifer, but it's about getting the water out of the aquifer, making sure we're meeting any sort of treatment requirements, whether it's filtration, chlorination, what is their holding tank sizes? Do they have fire hydrant concerns? How many homes are connected? Because if you look at, for example, the well on my property produces about 7 gallons a minute. That's great for a single household. It could probably be sufficient for two households. But if I wanted to do a 10-party group B system on a 7 gallon per minute well, I'm going to need a very large holding tank to provide that instantaneous water demand if everybody's needing water at the same time. Whereas right now, like most individual wells, it's hooked up to a 50-gallon pressure tank. And so every time I turn on a tap, the pressure tank makes sure that the water pressure stabilizes, sends it forward, and then the well pump will trigger to turn on to keep the pressure tank full. And so when we look at what's available, it's considering all those components, not just how much water is in the aquifer, but how much water can we get out of the aquifer and get to those households. And so when we look at that in Island County, one of our first concerns is the quantity of water, specifically for those shoreline neighborhoods and seawater intrusion. And so we already have a map that has been updated since 2005, where we've identified areas that are at higher risk for seawater intrusion. And so there are areas that, when you kind of think about it, it makes sense. It's the Camino Panhandle, it's the West Beach area of outside of Oak Harbor. It's areas where the land tends to kind of shrink down, and there's also a lot of home development. And when we look at the actual well logs for those areas, that second figure with all the dots, the small dots, we also see that those areas also tend to have wells that are completed well below sea level. So if you look at down near the North Whidbey or down near Clinton, a lot of the wells down there, because the elevation difference, are completed 100 feet or more above sea level. So if you have a well and the bottom of your well is 100 feet above sea level, it doesn't matter how much water you pump, you're never going to pull salt water up to your well. Whereas when you have wells like on the Camino Panhandle, where pretty much every well that's drilled on there is going to be below sea level, you are in areas that are going to be more prone to then seawater intrusion. So we have looking at how much water can you pump out without pulling in that brackish water, and then coupling that with, well, what is the water quality in that area? So we have natural contaminants like arsenic, where we know that you can tap into the aquifer there and there's plenty of water, but it's going to have high arsenic. So then you have to provide treatment. So it adds that extra cost component and can be a bigger burden for an individual homeowner if you have to treat all at your own expense versus if it's spread across 50 homeowners. And then other factors that come with more increased development, things like increasing the nitrate loading from septic systems, from everybody wanting to have their, you know, horses on their 5-acre lots, and, you know, all those kind of things. So all those factor into how these water systems are going to get potable water that meets drinking water standards out of the ground and to a household. So when we start looking at that in Island County, one of the obvious things that we came up with pretty quickly with the planning department team was, when you want a water connection for a household that's even at the 100% AMI level, it's typically going to be in an area that's already served by a public water system, just because of the cost difference between having to drill a well, and a lot of the parcels outside those areas tend to be those larger 5-10 acre parcels that quickly increase the cost of building a new home. So this is a map layer that we've worked with the planning department on that includes all of the two-party Group A and Group B water systems in Island County. So if you're within one of those shaded areas, there's a good chance that you either are on a water system or there's a water system that you could potentially connect to. And so when we look at those kind of by the numbers, we have about 300 Group A water systems. We have about another 600 Group Bs and another 600 two-party. And then just for comparison, there's about 7,600 individual wells in Island County that are serving one household. So even though we only have, you know, there's not as many Group As as there are Group Bs and two-parties, those Group As include systems serving anywhere from 15, 20 connections all the way up to the city of Oak Harbor, serving, you know, thousands of connections. And so population-wise, most of the population in Island County tends to be hooked up to one of these Group A water systems. And so when we look at those water systems, one of the easy things right off the bat is, well, what's available right now? Because they have to track if the water system's designed to have 150 connections, they have to keep track of how many they've allocated, how many are actually in use, how many are available. And so right now there's 201 water systems that combine of those Group A's that have about 3,700 connections available. So if you bought a parcel in that water system, there's a connection available right now that you can tap into. So there's no having to drill a new well just for you. There's no the water system having to get approval from the state or the county to add more connections. It's currently available, kind of the easiest water to get in the county. Group B's at about another 500. And then even those ones that are at capacity or are those kind of unapproved, unspecified systems, they can still get more connections. And so one of the things that we typically see with water systems that are in high seawater risk areas, like the Sierra Country Club, is they do rolling connections. So every other year they come in and they ask for 5 more connections. They go through all the data they've collected, how they're managing their system to show that they're not causing seawater intrusion and that the system can support 5 more connections. And then that gets approved by a partnership between the State Department of Health and Island County to say, yep, we agree they can take 5 more connections. And so even some of those systems that are at, you know, quote unquote, zero connections, it's zero connections today, but they could already be planning to add 5, 10, whatever it be, more connections. And so when we look at those, you know, adding more water connections and connecting more systems, the perk of these ones that are already available is those are systems that were already designed to serve those. They've already done all the pump tests. They've done all the testing to show we have the capacity. So we have the water availability to pump it out of the ground, treat it, and get it to those households to serve those residents. So it's no new science or engineering is required to connect to those connections. When we start looking at the ones, especially the ones in sewer intrusion risk areas, we start looking at things of, well, how do we get these curves like what Las Vegas, New York, or Los Angeles and New York, where they see increasing growth and decreased water demand. So less water use per person. And that's kind of the goal of what we want to see with any water system that's in a high risk area. That's always one of the things when they come and say, hey, we want two more connections to build those last two parcels in our water system. We say, okay, how can we get you those new connections without you pumping out more water, or even better, reducing your water use overall, your pumping volume? And so one of the first things we look at is when we're assessing the system and they want more connection is, what is your distribution system leakage? So it's the water that's pumped out of the ground that doesn't get charged to a customer. So it's lost between the well and the meter. So everything after the meter gets charged to a customer. Everything before the meter is water that's lost out of the system. It's the state calls it distribution system leakage. And so the goal set by the State Department of Health is under 10%, and then improvements every year to try to keep lowering it. But the standard is to be under 10%.
Doesn't 10% seem like a lot?
It really is a lot. 10% is the goal because, as you can see, like in the table, there's a lot of systems that are well over 10%. And the goal is to get to 10%. So then there's no, they remove additional requirements of infrastructure upgrades, but then it's to then show continuous improvement. Because the idea is you're never going to get to zero, because it's impossible to find those pinhole leaks where you're pumping a million gallons and you somewhere in the system you lost 1,000 gallons over the entire year. So you're losing less, you know, 1 to 2 gallons a day. It's really hard to find when you're the town of Coopville, the city of Oak Harbor.
Sure.
But it's capturing especially those large volume losses, because as I kind of summarize in this table, this data is a little old. It was the last one that was available in Excel form from the state, but in 2021, just the Group A systems in Ion County lost 190 million gallons.
Yeah.
So in comparison, those same systems used an average of 143 gallons per day per connection. So that's equivalent to about 3,700 houses worth of water for the entire year that get lost. And this is those classic things of, you know, main breaks in the main distribution line that caused the leaks. It's things like leaky storage tanks. It's all things that the just kind of wear and tear on the system. It's natural occurring. And then it can also be, you know, accidents when, you know, you don't do the line locate and you get a little too gung-ho with the backhoe and you hit a water line.
Sure. You said 3,700 a day.
The 190 million gallons would be equivalent water demand of to serve another 3,700 homes without pumping more water out of the ground. So that's water that we're already pumping out of the ground. And then the theory is, or the argument that I'll typically hear is, yeah, but it leaks and then it infiltrates back in, but it doesn't, because you also lose water to plants pulling it out. It's harder in Western Washington. In my previous job, when I still lived in Montana, it was easy to find breaks, because in July, if you're not watering and there's a green spot,
sure,
that's where your break is. Whereas here, you know, especially this last year, we had that really wet August, so things stayed green. So it's harder to find those leaks, especially if they're really small leaks. Mm-hmm. But it's just that idea that if we can find those leaks and correct them, you know, I had a water system, it would have been 2 years ago now. They wanted three more connections. They came up with a plan of, hey, this is what we're going to do. And one of them was fixing a mainline leak that they had. And so after they fixed it and we awarded those three new connections, they're using less water today than they used 5 years ago. Because even with more connections, they're not leaking out that water.
And if I'm sorry to
hop up
on this part, but now I'm obsessed. If a system is above the 10%, they get feedback from the regulatory agency that says go in there and find that? Or who's monitoring that leakage amount? How regularly are they monitoring and what's required to fix it?
Yeah, so these numbers are pulled from the water use efficiency form. It's a document that all Group A water systems have to fill out. They fill it out for an entire year, and then it's due by July the following year to the state. And then when the systems have extremely high leakage, that's when the state will step in and start working with them to develop a management plan to address those leakages and figure out, you know, how are you going to, you know, do you need to change your rates? What do you need to do to have the funds available to fix those issues?
And for single family wells, there's not then an oversight regulatory process for that. So
no.
You could be leaking whatever.
Yes. Yeah, so for group B's, two parties and individual wells, there's no metering and reporting requirements. So there's no requirement to show this is how much water came out of my well and this is how much made it into my house. And typically that's done. So like for my own instance with my private well, when I first moved in, I noticed my electric bill was a lot higher than it should have been. And then my well pump died. And so I was able to put two and two together and find out that, in fact, I actually had a leak. And so my well was just constantly running and it burned up the pump. And so it's pretty, if you've lived there a while, it'll be very noticeable because your baseline electric bill will suddenly jump up. You know, it'll be, you know, maybe in the summer your electric bill was $80 and then the next month it's $190. And you're like, well, I wasn't running heaters. And so that's usually a big one to look at is a well pump issue and or a leakage issue.
Okay. I didn't know that either.
Yeah. So that number, you know, we call it leakage, but it's really just that unnecessary withdrawal. So it's that trickle out of your groundwater bank of water that you didn't need to pump out. And then the other, so that, you know, capturing that leakage. And then the other thing we really look at with the water systems is how is your system using water? And so when we see, this is kind of a typical graph that every water system in the country shows, where we have our baseline winter usage is normal indoor household usage. And then when we see these peaks, especially July, August, September, which are when we start seeing things like the watering lawns, the, you know, filling the community pool, all those kind of other water uses that tend to be exterior water uses. And so this is another area where we will work with water systems to say, okay, you want another connection. Let's look at your summer water use. Is there any way, could you switch to an odd even day watering schedule? Could you change how you're managing your pool, the community pool, so you're not having to fill it up as often? And so we'll find some other ways where they can conserve water to ideally, the goal is to kind of cancel out. So you're gonna use more water with your new connections, but we're gonna offset that by saving water other places. So it's, you know, it's, I was explaining to people, you know, it's doing with water what every adult should be able to successfully do with their checking account.
Well, now you're talking.
Balance, you know, make sure the outputs do not exceed the inputs. And so that's kind of really it, is I just wanted to give that high level overview and really stress that, you know, when we talk about the comp plan, I know there's this big push, especially from the community, about do we have water and is the water available? And, you know, as those numbers showed, we have the water available to add all the new homes that we need right now without doing any new science, without doing new engineering, without adding new water systems. And a lot of it is just encouraging development in those established service areas. And when we do build in those areas, make, you know, encouraging them to connect to the water systems and not try to split off and form their own water system. And, you know, one of the things we see now is there's that a lot of water systems where they were one water system, they split, and now they're trying to merge back together. And, you know, as if either of you speak with Mr. Lovey, John Lovey, he can give you a very long account of how successful he has been in trying to merge two water systems, one of which he belongs to on the south end, and it's not an easy task.
I have, I think, five questions here. So, and I'll work backwards. So your last slide, you had a water consumption example chart. Is that an Island County chart or just a generic chart?
This is an Island County chart. I don't remember which water system it was. It's hard in Island County. I have to go by the water systems where I've driven through a lot to know, like, is this summer usage or from exterior water use, or is this vacation homes? and increase water use,
Sure.
which we see as well. And in fact, we actually saw a big increase in some of the larger water systems post COVID. And so when there was the work from home order in during the height of COVID, there was a large influx of vacation homes that now became primary residences. And so that's actually something we communicate a lot with water systems when they're looking to expand is, well, what percentage of your homes right now are vacation homes? And could you still provide water if all of those were primary residences tomorrow? Because we've seen those dramatic shifts before. And so, you know, this one was, yeah, it was a group-based system that had about 100 connections, and most, if not all, were primary residences.
Okay.
And just for reference, that green box, if just that percentage of the water was about 30% of the total year-wide water use. So about 30%. And that's even typical what we see in large cities across the nation is anywhere from a quarter to a third of the water use during the summer is exterior water use. That's why during severe droughts, California always says no filling the swimming pools.
Right. No watering your plants. My next question was, in your example that Las Vegas, LA, and New York City have all found ways to increase growth while decreasing their water use, I just wanted to understand, is and all of that action was done by reducing water leakage, or was were there other actions that they took?
It's always a combination. It's reduced water leakage. It's changing. It's changing a lot of water policies. So there's, and even in Island County, we have you know, homeowners associations that require you have to have a green lawn. You can't do xeriscaping. You can't do drought tolerant. You have to have green grass. Everybody's front lawn should look like it's a golf course kind of mentality.
Uh-huh.
And then a lot of it too was like in Las Vegas, for example, they said commercial businesses, you don't need a green lawn. So no, there was, they banned the use of irrigation water for businesses that, you know, so it's all those green strips. They said switch to drought tolerant native plants.
Okay.
And so it's a kind of a combination of, you know, conservation, changing policies. And a lot of it is just the changing attitude, because there's some people that no matter how expensive you make the water, they want the lush green grass. They want the Better Homes and Garden magazine cover lawn and, you know, front yard house kind of combination.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of it is kind of balancing of there's some people you will never reach, but if you can reach 10%, well, that's 10% less water that you're using.
You said that the state will step in and point out that your group A is using too much water. Do they identify ways to pay for it? Because part of our difficulty, I think, is here in Island County, we have all of these aging water systems that'd be so expensive to replace.
Yes. You know, with the changing landscape as it is, I don't know what funds are still available, but at the state level, Group A water systems, there's a lot more grant and low interest, zero interest loans available for Group A water systems. There's virtually nothing available for Group B water systems because Group B systems don't fall under the federal definition of a public water system.
Mm-hmm.
So all public funds that go to the state only go to Group A water systems. So, you know, I always encourage people that if you need help for large infrastructure projects, you are better off merging two small Group Bs into a Group A and then going after federal funds than trying to, because otherwise your only option then is interest or higher interest loans to the water system or raising rates for everybody across the board in your water system to pay for that infrastructure.
Okay, thank you. You had maps showing the arsenic levels and so on. Do we have a map showing the PFAS in our water?
So let's see here if I can. And let me switch my screen here.
Jill or Melanie, can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you.
Okay, I had a question, and it lines with the question you're asking now. We've talked a lot about water quality. I'm curious about the intersection between leakage and the issues of water. I mean, we talked about water quantity, the issues between water quality and leakage, where if you have both water quality challenges like PFAS, like manganese, like saltwater intrusion, and you have leakage, is that a double whammy, and how does that interface?
Yes. Yeah, so first, So this is the groundwater dashboard that we set up that has all the groundwater data available. And we don't, so PFAS is a whole group of contaminants. So we
Right,
break it
right.
out to just the ones that have MCLs, maximum contaminant levels established by EPA. And so like PFOA. So gray dots, there's no information. All the blue dots are public water systems. So group A water systems are required to sample for PFAS at least once by the end of this year. So we're getting a lot of data coming in. I think the only
And they've set a part per milliliter or whatever standard for that.
part, yeah, part per trillion,
Part
which
per trillion.
yeah, it, I so for something like nitrate, it's parts per million, which is the equivalent of like roughly a tablespoon in, I think it's like a 20-gallon fish tank, or a teaspoon in a 20-gallon fish tank. A part per trillion would be that same teaspoon, but in oh, it was like 30 something thousand of those fish tanks. So it's incredibly low levels. And so of all the water systems that have been collected so far, for PFOS, there's been one, and then there's another analyte, which I'm having trouble clicking on the screen.
Sure, that's
But
okay.
there's been two water systems in Island County that have had exceedances for a PFAS MCL
Okay.
that have been in an individual well. There's another one that has an exceedance, but they only sampled the combined source. And so we don't know if it was one well or both of their wells that has the issue. And so far, they haven't gone back to resample the individual wells to see if they can just shut off one of their wells. And then from the leakage standpoint, typically what we see is if you have leakage, your well pump's going to be running more. So if you have something like seawater intrusion that's caused by overpumping, it's going to get worse. And then those leaks, because they depressurize the system when water's pushing out, but if your pressure drops, now whatever's out can get in. And so that's typically where we see bacteria, the bacteria from the soil entering into the system. And then you get things like the boil water orders due to total coliform detections in the system.
Thank you. Were you able to answer Janet's?
I think if I, her question, may, tell me if I get it wrong, is with the leakage that's going out, can you recontaminate the aquifer? Was that kind of the question? With like if you have PFAS in there, does it recontaminate the aquifer? Was that it?
Well, the question, the answer you just gave of when you have leakage and you have depressurized systems and you have things that can come back in and then you have other things answered my question, if that's the summary of the answer. I mean, I think that makes sense to me.
Okay. I have two others. Do Group A's A systems under either a county or state code have a responsibility to have fire hydrants?
Ooh, I mean, that would be a better question for public works. There are, depending on like the size of the system, there are requirements, but there's also waivers that can be issued. And so, but that falls under the public works code in Island County.
I'd say that simply because I know of type Group A's in Island County that do not have fire hydrants that were built a gazillion years ago, right?
Yeah, and so in the slide I had shown where we have approved and unapproved systems, those unapproved systems are systems that were built through regulation. And so because of things like they don't have firefighter flow or their wells are too close to, they can't maintain proper setbacks under current requirements, they're registered, but they're not a approved system because they don't meet current requirements under the law.
Okay, thank you.
They still have to meet all the water quality and all those kind of requirements. They just can't meet, there's usually setback requirements or something like that that they can't meet.
Thank you. And my last question was at a Board of County Commissioners work session recently, Public Works brought to the board a proposal about rezoning in Freeland to add more houses for in a business, in a to support a business. And my concern about that really only was that I have heard from the Freeland Water Board in the past that they have run out of licenses or whatever, shares, water shares. So this would require another couple hundred water shares, I suppose. What is the process? I mean, does that mean that this project that this rezoning is moot because there's no water shares? What is the
Yeah, so I don't know specifically how many approved connections they have and how many are in use. I know since I've been started, I've worked with them on some projects where they've been trying to identify a place to drill a new well for water systems. So like I gave the example, my well produces 7 gallons a minute. When you look at the wells for like a Freeland Water and Sewer or Oak Harbor's backup wells that supplement their surface water connection through Anacortes, those wells are 80, 100, 150 gallon a minute wells. So they're larger diameter, they're drilled deeper, and they move a lot more water. And so in Freeland's example, they were, I don't remember off the top of my head exactly, but I think they were looking for a well to produce somewhere in the 80 to 100 gallon a minute well, and they hadn't been successful in the first attempt. And so in those cases, it's something where I don't know if it's they need it to add any new connections, or if that's their planning for over the next 50 years, we know we need this much more water. And there's always options available. A lot of it comes down to how far away are you willing to drill and then have to run pipe to your new well. So if all your infrastructure is on the south end of Freeland, do you really want a well on the north end of Freeland that you then have to pipe all the way through town, or do you want it somewhere closer? And so there's all those kind of factors that go into not just the cost to drill, but then the pipe to and the physically just running pipeline to connect it to your system. But it is something that I know they have been working on.
Okay, thank you. That's all.
But now back to Freeland, because we need to put the housing there. I mean, we have a septic problem too, different conversation. But that up to 10% loss rate would be enough to absorb. I'm
And
obsessed
you're
with the
right.
loss rate
You're
because to
right.
me, it's like first you fix what you're losing, then I was going to ask you a question about how much you can expect to save in behavioral changes. Like, I mean, I don't, well, that's not true. I'm pretty water conscious. I would say, like, let's say 15 years ago, not water conscious. So I would just take as many baths as I want. I'd run the laundry like I wanted, the dishwasher, good enough, I'll run it. Right now, I scream about that. But let's say in my pre-commissioner life, how much water could someone conceivably reduce? Like, what would be a realistic reduction percentage, you think?
I mean, it really depends on how. So water systems have different ways that they can encourage conservation. And the one that is typically used is a weighted fee structure. So the first X, the first 1,000 gallons is this amount, and then it's everything beyond that is going to be an extra dollar amount per gallon. And I know there's some where they have gone to extremely high rates, and I have been told that by one community that there's a member of the community who was fine paying over $1,000 a month for water because he was going to have a green lawn on the beach. There was no amount of money he wasn't willing to spend. So a person like that, you're never going to change.
Sure.
And but the, you know the, there's the flip side of that of it's not just about the water use, but sometimes it's a require if it's when it's requirements like you have to have green lawns. I despise mowing my lawn. I absolutely hate it. The few perks of the long, brutal winters in Montana was I mowed my lawn twice, and then it was a drought and everything died, and I didn't have to worry about it again until next spring. Here, mowing, like, I never thought I'd live someplace where you mow your lawn in January, but I did because I have kids and dogs who want to play in the backyard. But if you remove that barrier of, hey, if you don't want a green lawn in your front yard, you want to have droughtscaping, you want to have, dead grass, whatever, even just changes like that, where there's no longer that requirement to have a green lawn. A lot of people see it as, I'm not trying to save water. I'm just trying to save my Saturday morning from having to mow the lawn once a week. And so it's targeting not just the water conscious people, but hey, how much, how you that's another round of golf that you could have on Saturday if you didn't have to mow your lawn. It's targeting those kind of behaviors too. And a lot of it is things that you don't even have a choice anymore. When you go to Home Depot, I just bought a new dishwasher. I don't Every dishwasher now has that little, energy water star
Yeah.
thing on it. It's new toilets, old toilets in the 90s. It was 3 to 5 gallons per flush. Now standard is about a 1.5. So even just new, when you're replacing old infrastructure with new infrastructure, it's so much more water efficient that even just those savings alone add up.
I'm just trying to figure out how much capacity exists in just simply infrastructure maintenance and behavioral changes before even putting in a robust new system, right? So if you think about Freeland digging a new well, putting that in, pulling it all out, how much water is being pulled out right now could conceivably support how much population growth? Like, do
Yeah.
we already have it in the systems? We just have to alter the number of times we wash something.
Yeah, a lot of it is you have to look at kind of each system individually. I'm not sure what the leakage is for like Freeland water and sewer, but for a lot of those systems, that's kind of the first step is that I've talked to some of the smaller systems on is before you think you need a new well, let's get all the low-hanging fruit. What other changes can you make? Because if it's maybe even if you spent the money on a new well, if you're still leaking 15%, you're still leaking 15% even with the new well. And so if it's addressing those leaks first, and then there's the added benefit of, if you cut the leakage, the well pump's running less, that means you're saving money on the electricity around the well pump. The life expectancy of the well pump is going to go from, 5 years to 10 years kind of thing, because it's, everything has a set lifespan. And so the fewer times that pump turns on, the longer its lifespan is.
And then can I ask one more question about the water rights?
Yep.
So for, I'm still going to stick with Freeland because that's where my head is now. So for Freeland, if they were to go out there and put in another well to pull out another 80 gallons per minute, is that a new water right or is that utilization of an existing water rights, right?
It depends. If they're not currently using their full water right and their well, I don't know what this distance is are allowed by ecology right now, but if you have this well and it's a you can your water right says 300 gallons a minute, but that well only produces 150 and you put another well 200 feet away, you can combine those both wells as one water right. If it was something where they're going to have the well here and the other well is 7 miles away, that's not going to be considered a same water right, and they're going to have to go through that process for the new well.
And then for single family homes, they don't get a water right.
So a single family home and wells that serve smaller two-party small group B systems, they can run off of what is an exempt use well status, and so that says you get up to 5,000 gallons per day for residential use. Or residential use and irrigation, but it's still capped at that 5,000 gallons. And for if you're watering, so like on my property, I have a well, serves my house. I have 5 acres. If I wanted to water the entire 5 acres, I'd have to get a water right. I can only water up to half an acre of land. So if you have 8 houses sharing a well, they could be on an exempt use well, but that means their combined yards that are being watered would have to be under that half acre.
And who regulates that?
Ecology. That's so that all falls under the water right permitting system that ecology operates.
And if there was a scenario, we got a lot of community concern about how we're running out of the water. I don't know where this started, but whatever. So if that were to be a scenario, I guess my assumption would be last in, first out, that somebody would start coming in and saying, you've lost water, you've lost water. Or how do those water rights work in terms of usage? As the first person with the water right, so a lot of agricultural lands have water rights that I thought were first. I maybe that's wrong, but I learned that they were first. Do they get to do whatever they want with water, and then the last house built is the one that restricts, or what's the sequencing if you were in a reduction scenario?
So it can get pretty complicated, but in a nutshell, it goes first as senior right, water rights get all their water.
Okay.
Then you give water to the junior rights. That's typically how it's applied to surface water, but it's a lot easier with surface water because if you look at a river like the Yakima River, we know the river that you know, the water of the river that flows by Ellensburg is the same drop of water that's going to flow by Yakima in a couple of days, or, you know, whatever the case may be. With groundwater, it's not quite that easy. So it's typically, if you and I are neighbors and you decide, hey, I'm going to put in a bigger pool and I'm going to be pumping more water and my well goes dry, I have to show that my well was first and your use is impacting my use.
Okay.
And so it gets a lot more complicated with groundwater, but yeah, that it's typically, you know, senior first to junior, for the, if you go all the way through the exempt wells, then you, it's the adjudication process where you have to start looking at when was that well put into use. And so you start looking at like building records and when was the home built, and, oh, well, before it was this home, it was grandpa's fishing cabin in 1903 and he hand dug that well, kind of. So it gets very complicated very quickly.
And what do you think is the population maximum before you, you don't want me to ask this? I can tell from the body. You get in a scenario where you're talking about groundwater, first come, first serve.
Yeah, no, that's it's a really good question. It gets really complicated because Oak Harbor and NAS Whidbey don't use groundwater. And so you're assuming that they're still getting it from the Skagit via Anacortes. And, you know, you're assuming there's so many other options.
All things being equal. How about that? All things being equal.
So the best way I can say this is there are water systems that they are at capacity. They're never going to get another connection. And there's other water systems that are greatly underutilized and they could triple and you would not have an issue. And so it's not a whole island.
Got it.
It's really pockets and zones. So, you know, the areas where we have seawater intrusion, there's water systems that have been dealing with seawater intrusion since the 1980s. They're never, you know, they're at 30, 40, 50 connections. They're not going to go up anymore.
Then what is the intersection between water systems that can grow? Emily, this is for you, I think, but Chris is going to take a shot. And I don't need to know now, but just for thought process, water systems that can grow and placement of housing and growth versus water system that can't. So we've been talking about density in association with like raids or lamrids, and lamrids, that's the word I want. And those areas that maybe could be eligible, but not necessarily an underlying evaluation of where the water rights would exist to absorb more growth versus where they wouldn't exist to absorb more growth. Is there a connection point between that zoning or no?
I don't know from the planning perspective, but from the water perspective, you can, it's a lot. If you already have areas that are dense and you want to make them denser, it is a lot easier to move water from where you have it to where you need it than it is to move whole communities sometimes. So the great example is Sierra Country Club. They know they needed more water, that their wells, they have seawater intrusion. They are only at like 50% development. They went farther north to a better area to get water in an area that's, there's ag fields. It's never going to become rural development. They get a water right. They work with the landowner. They put in the water line. So they've moved water from where we have abundance to where we need it, because we already had the, you know, the platting's already done. We already know how many parcels are in the Sierra Country Club. And so that is, especially when you're looking at that number of homes, it's a lot easier when, because then that pipe to run the water from here to there is being paid for by, you know, 300 or 400 homes eventually. I don't know what the total size of that development is once it's fully built out. So then it's, you know, the cost per consumer goes way down. And so I think that, and that's, I mean, that's exactly what Oak Harbor and NAS Whidbey did. They looked at it a long time ago and said, we can keep drilling wells or we can go to Anacortes.
Yeah, that works until you get your senior water rights, right? That's what you just explained about Ellensburg.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know how senior their water rights are, but there's
third and fourth.
Yeah,
in line,
but
I think.
And those are, you know, the, when we look at kind of that whole process, a lot of it is how do you get, I mean, it's what California's done at a statewide scale, moving water from Northern California, where you have abundance, down to LA. They've been doing that for almost 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I was thinking about something and now it's zipped away again.
Can a water system, it's going to come back to her.
Yeah.
Can a water system that is at capacity refuse to grow? So if, for example, you could put more connection points in there by doing what Sierra did, and our zoning says, yes, we need you to take more connections because you're the appropriate place for growth to happen based on the limitations of where we can put density. Does the water system have a right to refuse that? Or does the authority lie with the zoning and they have to do that?
So that gets tricky because under the state that they say, you know, water systems have a duty to serve. That's, you know, considered their existing service area. And so, you know, unless there was big parcels that you could divide up, but a lot of those is if the water system was, is at capacity with, let's say, 50 connections, their whole infrastructure was designed for 50 connections. And so sometimes the resistance to grow is because it's not just adding a new well, it's larger pipes, bigger reservoir, bigger treatment. And so, you know, in those cases, it might not pencil out to where it's feasible for them to do it. And so a lot of it comes at a, you know, it, a kind of a case by case basis for the actual water system of what's feasible.
So for the last, thank you for that. So for the last 5 years, I, in my area, my folks, they tend to get very anxious about the amount of water we have to support the community. And what I'm hearing from you today, Chris, is that that's not where your anxiety should be. If you're going to be anxious about water, quantity is not the anxiety you should be carrying on your shoulders. I'm hearing, tell me if I'm wrong, that a takeaway from this is that it's really more about water quality than it is quantity here in Island County as we're working on our comp plan.
And I would say it's not just water quality, it's the infrastructure. We have, you know, Derek Pell with the Department of Health came back in, I believe it was June, maybe July. And that's what he spoke about a lot is, you know, we've developed and we've grown with this cheap water where everybody was paying $20. And it was great because when you put that pipe in the ground, it has a life expectancy of 40, 50, 60 years. Unfortunately, they were put in the ground 40, 50, 60 years ago. And just like our, you know, our roads are, all of the visual infrastructure above ground that you can see, the stuff below ground also ages and needs to be replaced. And when you were paying $20 a month for your water, that was paying for all the basic needs today, but it was never planning for tomorrow. And that's the big thing that I think is, if, you know, if I have any concerns about water in Island County, the biggest concern is the infrastructure and the need to better maintain the infrastructure at the community and the, you know, that water, public water system level.
Thank you very much. Janet has.
Oh, sorry, Janet.
No, it's okay. You guys have been asking great questions. Some of the same things I was wondering about. And it's much easier if you do it. So that is probably my greatest concern. It was water quantity was least, water quality was second, but my greatest concern has been infrastructure. A lot of what I hear from communities in my district. So what is available? Like, is Craft 3 available to them if they need to do infrastructure improvements? You know, we know they need to be doing reassessments and planning for the future. What other resources are available to them for those infrastructure needs that we have across the county?
Yeah, so... you know, for the, if you're a Group A water system and you're worried about infrastructure, working with the State Department of Health, the local engineer is kind of your first bet because they know all the different resources that are available right now for those Group A water systems. For Group B water systems, the individual homeowners, the two parties, a lot of that came down to a combination of self-funding. There historically has been USDA, rural development programs. I don't know which of those, if any, are available today or will be available in the future. But a lot of it is, you know, it, anytime systems ask, it's, I can't tell you a lot of things about like how much water you're going to need in the future, what, how many houses are going to be on Whidbey Island. But what I can tell you is with a guarantee However much it costs to fix a pipe today is cheaper than it will be tomorrow. That's something that we've seen time and time again. And so that, that it's kind of like with the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago, the second best time is today. And so it's, if it means that everybody needs to be reassessed and instead of paying $20 to $50 a month, you're all paying $100 to $150 a month. If that's, your house is typically your biggest investment. And if you don't have water, your biggest investment has no value. And so a lot of it, it has to be done at that individual and at that community level to at least start the process. And then you can start looking into what USDA, what or potentially state grants are available or loans.
Is that CRAF 3 program still out there or no? That's where we used to do these loans through the county and it went to a company. I think that's the name. I think that's the name. And you could get a lower interest loan there. Is that out of business or I got the wrong name or I made it up?
No, we CRAF 3, we have the Clean Water Washington septic program, and it's available to our I don't believe it would be available to our Group B systems.
I haven't heard of any drinking water infrastructure projects being done through there. I don't
It's
know.
septic.
I think it's just septic, but I'd have to look
No,
into it to
I think
verify.
you're right. I think I got confused. Excellent.
Let's check into that because I had a friend who was their CFO until recent years and they were doing water projects in other areas. But can we check into that?
Yeah, make a note. Chris, also earlier you mentioned, the possibility of consolidation when it comes to those Group B systems. Sometimes that can temp, can increase expense and that can be challenging for the community, but longer term, having a larger organization overseeing that water system and bringing more together can help spread out the cost of infrastructure improvements. I don't need anything to add to that.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we've seen. Like for the Group Bs, there's potential that they won't be required to have like the SMAs anymore and the satellite management agencies. And a lot of that is triggered because those satellite management agencies have minimum fees they have to charge because you have to have staff that are available 24/7, and so you have staff that are on call, so there's always dollars going out the door. So they have to have those minimum fees, and when those minimum fees. If you have a minimum fee, it doesn't matter if that is a 8-person system or a 50-person system. And so typically what we see is, especially as you go to from Group Bs to Group As and to larger Group As, you're spreading those fairly constant fees over larger and larger numbers of people. So it's just, it's if it might be $50 a month for me on a 3-party system or a 4-person system, it is then $10 if we're a 20-person system. And so a lot of it is that with that growth, you don't just qualify for the state grants and the state loans, but there's just the larger pool of, investors into the water system. And so you can help to not just raise money, but pay for all those sort of services.
Yeah, the economies of scale on would be better for
Yes.
sure. Do we have other questions for Chris? Because I
I would
know.
love to.
No, you're up.
Oh, go ahead. I was going to say, I think this is incredibly interesting, great questions. And one of the least or the most misunderstood aspects of our county and development is, everybody gets straws in the water or whatever the fear is. And, we could talk about my community on South Plano that's really worried about things. I would love to see a series in Health Matters where this is in digestible bits, where here's the thing you need to know, and we can get this information out in bits where we keep reinforcing it. Because Chris, you've told this story in multiple ways, and we still have folks who don't fully understand, and we're looking to be in a place where we get information on a more steady level. So it would. If this is something, Sean, that we could put out on a regular basis for Health Matters or our other venues, I think this is the greatest anxiety, as Commissioner Bacon was saying, that people are carrying on their shoulders.
Yeah, we can certainly work on the communications piece. And I don't know, Chris, if you want to speak at all to the revamped, to the website and the resources we brought online there. But we're also working on pushing this out through social media, and we tend to get a lot of reach through Nextdoor in particular for this type of information. We'll continue.
Yeah, so we were lucky last year to add another member to the water team. So we added Tracy last year, and she has been a huge resource working with both Annetta and myself to one of the things that we've been targeting more is that education and outreach component. So we've been revamping the website. We've been working on, we've brought back our drinking water listserv. So it's a blast we send out quarterly about just drinking water related information to everybody who signs up for it in the county. And so that's a push we started making last year, focusing on those, the group Bs, the two parties, the individual well owners in Allen County, and trying to get them more resources and help them know what's out there and what's available to them.
Great. The one thing I would say, you know, I'm going to say it and then my colleagues will clean up the mess when we're done, but science is science, right? So we've said this, and it's not, I don't think, for a lack of understanding that people are willfully not hearing you say that we have enough water to absorb the growth that is projected. We've said it clearly. We've said it directly. We've shown the science behind it. Now, if I sat up here and said climate change isn't real, I would expect a series of emails that would come my way about how I'm an ignorant Republican and I don't know anything and I'm an idiot. I mean, I get those most of the time anyway, but usually not related to climate change. So I would get those emails and people would tell me, you've got to pay attention to the science. And they would be correct. And I would say back to the people who are refusing to hear us say that our science shows us that we have enough water availability to absorb the projected growth, the science is telling us it's fine. So either science is how we're making decisions or science isn't how we're making a decision. And if the science says we're fine and we continue with the community rhetoric that says we aren't, then just wear a t-shirt to a meeting that says, I don't want anybody else to move here because I'm here now and I just want to limit growth and drive up my property values. I would have more respect for you if you were honest about your motivations. But the science is telling us that we have enough water availability. Do I think that we are ripe for conversation about, you know, how we reclaim a little more water, about aquifer recharge, about behavioral incentives? Yes, because I think that's responsible, not just for today's growth, but for future generations. I don't think those conversations are off the table. But the motivation should not be the fear that we're running out of water, because our science is telling us that they are not, we are not. And that is the fact in which we will move forward upon, just like we are also acknowledging that the climate is changing. And that is a fact. And we will move forward with some policy decisions related to that. It's not okay to just politicize science for your own gain just because you like one piece of science and you don't like another. And I don't mean to be harsh about it, but we're pretty far through this growth management process and we've said the same thing repeatedly. And I think it's time we just say it directly. We don't have a water crisis in all scenarios. Some people have saltwater intrusion. We've got to figure that out on a one-off basis. But we do not have a countywide situation on our hands. And I can't be any clearer about it. I'm not going to speak for my colleagues. They have more patience and grace than I do. What I don't have patience and grace for is people who yelled at me about COVID and science and yell at me about climate change and science and assume that I don't follow the science and then turn around and don't follow it when they don't like the message. That's all.
So I probably would not have said that in quite those same way that you just did. I would say that I really appreciate having Dr. Kelly assure us that we have enough water. So thank you for that. That's a good message. We need to keep reiterating that message as people continue to be a little bit worried about that. We need to continue to remind them of that. But going forward, we still need to be conscious about things like water recharge and about protecting sources of water so that we don't have the leakage. Because what you're saying is in order for this to continue, we need to be paying attention to things like water leakage, about water use, about water recharge. That's what's going to keep us healthy in our water quantity issues going forward into the future. So we shall focus on that. We shall focus on our infrastructure. We shall focus on trying to clean up pollutants that are found in our water and finding alternatives to saltwater intrusion, which neighborhoods are finding ways to do that by moving their wells inland. We've had a couple of those. So this has been extremely informative, and I'm very grateful to you for this information.
Thank you for having me.
That's why Melanie Batts cleanup.
If I could briefly add, I know we're running a little over, but if it would be of interest to the board to have maybe a follow-up discussion on our monitoring program, because we are monitoring aquifer recharge.
Yes, definitely.
And to understand how that science, that scientific approach and the trends we're seeing.
Yep.
Also maybe to consider for policy as we develop our approach with our consultant around the coordinated water system plan and priorities, but to think about the emergency preparedness lens of our water infrastructure and maybe a future discussion topic. But when we think about infrastructure improvements, you know, if there are ways we can be earthquake ready and help ensure that our communities are resilient.
That'd be interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Chris. All right. Sean, you have a community health improvement plan timeline and activities. Taylor, I almost skipped you.
Good afternoon. I will be honest, my presentation is not as exciting as Chris's was, but more of an update that's visually appealing. So just gonna pull it up.
I would just say, in the interest of time, the finance update is all old news to our commissioners. So I'd recommend that we bring that back at a future meeting. It goes into quite a bit of detail on FPHS and our other funding streams that commissioners are well-versed in.
Sounds good.
I'm not going to need 5 minutes for pontification on this.
Right.
Okay, that saves us 5 minutes.
All right. Thank you for having me this afternoon. We are kicking off our community health improvement plan process. As a reminder, we are contracting with the same company who helped us, Heidi Pear II's consulting firm that helped us complete our community health assessment. So it'll be great to have her team continue with us in this work. The purpose of this presentation today is to provide a very general, brief overview of our last community health improvement plan. It was a while ago. And just giving a high-level overview of the project timeline for the CHIP and some of those chapters or steps that I'm happy to continue to bring to the board, but also as a announcement for the community. So a brief definition of the CHIP is a long-term effort to address public health problems based on the results from our community health assessment activities and the community health improvement process. So really taking the large document, as you all know, is over 100 pages from our community health assessment that gave us a landscape analysis of the health and well-being of our community and the priorities that naturally generated from that work from our community, taking it a step further and determining public health's role in addressing public or community health needs and finding ways to measurably and actionably address those measurably. Brief overview from our last CHIP, which was done in 2018. We had our high priorities were access to care, interpersonal abuse, housing, depression, and suicide. And some of the top ways in which we addressed those or identified ways that we wanted to address those were for access to care, looking at routine medical checkups in the last year. Interpersonal abuse was working with CADA and seeing how many clients were supported through CADA, along with some training opportunities as well. housing was looking more at the point in time for trying to decrease the number of individuals who were sleeping unhoused. And depression and suicides, the rate of suicide by Island County residents. A little bit more detailed is for access to care. We looked at, like I mentioned, the routine medical checkups. And this is still a system that we have access to for information. Our most current stat is on the furthest right. This was included in our community health assessment. 73.2% of our population identified as having a routine medical checkup. This is from a source, it's BRFSS, Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance Survey System. So it's a self-reported survey that's completed. It's usually a sampling survey. Typically folks will get a call and you answer questions based off the questions that they ask.
And are you able to see that by population, or that we're just going overall thematic, not breaking it down by demographic of?
Oh, gotcha. We can break it down into ages and sex, I believe. We can also look, I don't know if geography, I'll have to double check geography of Island County for specific regions, but I do know there's demographic variables that we can look at to break down.
Race.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the interpersonal abuse, as I mentioned, was with CADA, and we looked at the number of client intakes. I was not able to get information just because I hadn't. I will get information from CADA to get a more current figure for this, but this was actually included in one of our most recent updates on the community health improvement plan process, which was completed in 2022. So the most current data I had available for this presentation was from 2019, just a while ago.
Given the dynamics of running nonprofits, how different leadership changes can get you different results and different things, is there a way to pull that data point from the sheriff's office or ICOM to say the number of calls or the, I mean, I'm just a little concerned that CADA's ability to reach out might not be the most consistent storytelling mechanism just because funding model changes, leadership changes.
That's yeah, so absolutely. Important. There's certainly different ways that we can measure this.
Okay.
So we can look into the exploring different ways to measure this experience.
I like the trend down for sure. But I want to make sure that's really what's going on. Almost current 2019. Maybe I'm reading it.
Yeah, no, God knows really. What it was has been in the last 5 years.
Yeah. So maybe we can get data from
there. Sure. Yeah. Michael.
Okay. For housing, we were made aware of this recently with our most current. We don't have 2025's data from our point in time just because it was a few weeks ago, but our most current is 185 in 2024. So we see the increase based off of our target from 2020. And additionally, there are other ways that we can measure housing, as we've learned quite a bit through our comp plan process and with most recently, the Human Services team is working on their homeless housing plan. So we may actually have some more data to look at with regards to housing that's beyond the point in time count.
So what's interesting about this to me is this is indicating that our homeless count has doubled in 10 years. And so we know our population has not doubled. Generally, general population hasn't doubled in 10 years, but our homeless population has. I am curious to know if it's the sense that this is accurate, and if so, why, or is there a sense that this is just because our methods of counting have become more sophisticated?
Absolutely. And that's a very valid question. The efforts that go towards the point in time count, there's many factors to be considered, which is what's helpful when looking at other sources to really get a broader understanding of the impact this is having on our community.
WASAC has a podcast. I know you can't imagine anything more exciting than a county government podcast. But of course I listen because I'm cool. And it talked about the housing point in time count and how the criteria has changed. So like they used to not count, they used to be, you had to be unsheltered. Then they included couch surfing is unsheltered. And then they've changed the counting mechanism over the years, which makes the point in time count less valuable for consistent tracking. I think that might be a more accurate number, but from 2013, I think it includes criteria that it didn't include. And so again, that's another area where we might need to look at over the years to see if we're improving or not different data points, because I think the point in time count data has included and excluded and changed a little bit over the years in terms of who it's measuring.
Yeah, I think that if our homeless population has truly doubled in 10 years, we need to know that that's true,
mm-hmm.
right? Mm-hmm. We need to know that. So Commissioner, does WASAC have a TikTok channel for you?
It doesn't have a TikTok yet. I'm going to lobby to be their official TikToker because I'm not becoming an influencer anytime soon. So I may as well talk about something I know because people aren't coming to me for skincare recommendations, turns out. Shocking. I love TikTok.
I know you do.
For depression and suicide, one of the focused areas was around suicide. There's also other data sources that we have available other than our community health assessment tool. But as we can see between 2015 and our most current figure, it has not changed too terribly much, with our target really being quite a bit less. Additionally, as with all of these measures, there's so many different ways to measure depression and suicide and ways we can look at it that may, they are important to consider for sure in terms of how we as a public health department would address something like this. So,
actually, if this isn't true, then this is good news for us because our population in the last 10 years has gone up, what, at least 10%, 10 or 15%. So if this is true, then we're doing something right. So it's another thing for us to find out for measuring between 2015 and 2024, if the measurements utilized were the same or not.
I agree. And I don't want to be like unsuccessful because I like success. I also think that if we're going to keep a category like this, it would be interesting to consider how we view overdoses. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, it's an overdose, but the intentionality behind it isn't necessarily covered in that. Mm-hmm. And the reason somebody is involved in addiction isn't necessarily covered in that. So I think it'd be good to have a very holistic view of what we're I get that somebody, you know, that there are things where people say, well, that's an obvious suicide, but I think there's a lot of ways people commit suicide. Unfortunately, you can do it quickly or you could do it over time.
So as I mentioned, we did a recent update on our CHIP, which I'm happy to share that full document. I think it's closer to 5 to 7 pages, so it's pretty condensed, but it goes through each of our priorities from our community health improvement plan, our most recent one, and the not only the measurements, but also kind of the activities that we have engaged in order to address those needs. As we know, many of our plans were unfortunately put on hold or had to be pushed aside due to COVID. We had work groups at one point that were focused on each of these priority areas, and they had to disband for the time being because of our shifting of priorities for the moment, a long period of time. But as with all things, there are some strengths and opportunities that emerged from that process. And honestly, it's kind of interesting to see these strengths with regards to cross-sector collaboration, system-wide coordination, because in many ways, these are things that came through our CHA too. Folks were really excited about the opportunities around cross-sector collaboration and things that have been happening in most recent years between public health and our community. There was also a need that few people identified for system-wide coordination with regards to resources, communication, things that we were constantly trying to improve upon, but to see them also reflected in our CHIP from our last report is really, it just means we're on the right track. I think there's always opportunity for growth, but we're in the, going in the right direction. So here we are. We're starting off on our next plan.
Mm-hmm.
One of our epidemiologists put together this nice visualization of what we see as the community health assessment being the roots, or the, as I've mentioned before, a kind of a landscape where we're really reaching in and connecting with our community. And not to say that the improvement plan doesn't involve community at all, but it does really flourish in the sense of bringing it all together. And as you can see at the top of the tree, these are the steps that we'll be taking for our improvement plan. So prioritization meeting to define or determine priorities, our strategic workshop, which would be more with community leaders and partners, facilitating community data walks, and which are data walks typically have some sort of poster that has a lot of information on it. We've done some in the past with our health assessment results, where folks are invited to come and really just explore the information that we collected, ask questions, things to consider, just give general feedback about the process. And those can really generate a lot of conversations around things that we may have missed, but also things that people really appreciated were included. And then within those data walks, we'll also be including some of those chosen priorities that came through from our meetings and our strategic workshop, our strategy workshop with partners. There'll be a report, of course. And then Heidi and her team will be providing annual data summaries in collaboration with our internal team, where we'll continuously evaluate our efforts instead of coming to the end of the chip and determining what we've done. We'll be more strategic in looking at it at least annually to see what our efforts are, how our efforts are making an impact on the priorities. So this is a little bit subject to change. We've already seen it move a little bit, but just as a high level overview, we had our project kicked off meeting, which is when we were presented with this timeline earlier this year, last month. And then we're hoping to have our prioritization and strategy completed by the end of June. We'll do our community data sharing and data walks between June and September. I'm going to be connecting with planning on this one to see if we need to move that timeline around or piggyback in some way for comp plan considerations. But really the idea would be to gather some community input on that. And it would ideally be aligned in many ways with comp plan efforts. So it could be helpful for both teams. And then we'll write our report and have it ideally completed by the end of the year. Very much aligned with the comp plan.
Can you, oh, sorry.
Oh, I was just gonna say, so this is the year one scheduled, and you said you're gonna keep do this every year. Do you anticipate a similar schedule then for the next, whatever it was it through 2029? Is that what it is?
Yeah, so the next few years will honestly just more or less be, it could be what we would like it for it to be. What I envisioned was maybe an annual meeting of sorts with some of the community partners who were tangential and in creating the chip and also moving that work forward. It could also be a lot of internal planning where we're revisiting it as a public health department and seeing where our priorities within the chip are with our existing body of work, making sure they're still aligned. But then the real intentional task would be for Heidi and her team to work with us to really update and refresh the data every year to just evaluate more consistently how our efforts are reflected in any kind of change in the information.
Oh, public is misspelled on that slide.
Oh, thank you. I will update that.
Can you help me understand? I know there's a reason. Why the data analysis happens after the strategy? Like, wouldn't you look at the data and then develop your strategy? Can you help me understand how those two things relate? Because I would have done it different, and I know there's a reason. I just don't understand it.
So when updating strategy by reflecting on the data that we've identified as our kind of our benchmarks, is that what you're asking?
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe I'm not understanding where we are in the process. So I would look at the data to try to figure out my priorities and strategies, but this has us looking at developing the priorities and strategies first and then data second. So I'm assuming we'd look at the data to determine progress on our priority areas, but I didn't, but how are we determining the priorities based on data points or?
Yes. Yeah. From the community health assessment that we completed will help us to inform what priorities public health will have in addressing the needs that we saw through our community health assessment.
It's report. A couple slides forward.
Okay. And did we pull, I've got ICOM on the mind, our mind today, but did we pull ICOM data? Because, so again, when I look back at where we were on this process before, I think it's good we're taking community feedback, but the community is concerned about things that oftentimes are headline items or they get talked about a lot, but not always the reality of what is going on, right? So like, I mean, again, depression and suicide, I think came out of the community youth assessment, maybe that point. But if you were to talk with ICOM, I know they do a lot of like, they have a lot of concerns around senior isolation. We have a lot of calls going out around that. Trips and falls, a major issue for certain populations. They've got data points of like, not like necessarily mental health or quality of life health or social indicators of health, but like actual, these are what's causing ER visits or shortened lifespan data points that I wouldn't necessarily know about, except for I sit on ICOM and I hear them talk about things and I'm like, oh, I didn't know that was even a problem, right? That has that all been looked at, or there's still an opportunity to gather that data and to have it inform the strategy?
Yes, there's still time. So let me see. So with the prioritization meeting, we may start with these high level CHA priorities, housing, mental health, senior services. What was the other one? I'm sorry.
Healthcare access.
Thank you. And we may, you know, within that conversation, determine that public health may not be able to take that on right now. But there are other partners in the community mm-hmm. who are actively working on that. So that would be the time to really set those priorities that we as a public health department can address. So we do have a senior falls coalition, prevention coalition. Is that where we would like to focus our energy in order to tackle one of these challenging issues that we're seeing on a community level? And so that's when that conversation would happen, where we're setting realistic expectations for ourselves okay. and within our body of work, really. Because we don't want to be starting on an entirely new chapter of a work when we are not already focused on somewhat in some way working towards those solutions.
I'd like to pile on to Commissioner Johnson's comment about ICOM. We learned this morning that ICOM in 2024 received 96,000 calls. Now, every one of those calls is a data point. Every one of them is. And so I think that we would not be doing ourselves justice if we did not utilize that really pretty profound piece mm-hmm. of information that we have there, that resource.
Yes. And just to jump in, so when we go through the community health assessment process, you know, we're looking at pulling together qualitative data, which are those stories, the narratives from our community members and, you know, interviews with community partners and leaders. And then we have our data workbook, which is our quantitative data. And so that data workbook, we're looking at a number of sources. We're looking at ER data. We're looking at ICOM data. So we're pulling together all mm-hmm. the quantitative data. And then the CHA process is about looking at all of that mm-hmm. and then coming to that, you know. And so that's what we'll be revisiting in that early stage prioritization. Here's everything we brought together. Here's what rose to the surface. Senior services being items that did come forward in the data. Where do we go from here? Okay. And what services are we offering? What can we strengthen? We're really invested in a strengths-based approach where we're not, like Taylor mentioned, trying to add completely new bodies of work, but where are we already leaning in and how, but that'll be a discussion for that session. And of course, Board of Health direction. So
okay.
more to come on that.
I mean, I'm not trying to be controlling. I think what I'm worried about is elevating the same conversations over and over again when, like, you know, again, housing, high priority, a lot of work being done around housing, a lot of money going towards housing, a lot of community attention on housing. When, like, as we were sitting here talking, I'm like, gosh, we've had a lot of car accidents, right? And so we don't traditionally think about driver safety as a public health issue, but shoot, if it was my kid I had to bury, I would think of nothing else, right? And so are we looking broad enough at some of these things where we just want to pull up other, you know, ICOM, you get four or five calls from a car accident, right? That's what got me thinking, but also thinking about the fact that that is, that awareness raising is such a public health role that I don't also want to just be limited to existing work that we, so we keep replowing the same ground and we're letting something else become a crisis because we're not really looking and saying, why is all this happening over here? So, okay, you're on it.
It's really important to take that holistic approach in the CHA and then carrying that forward into the CHIP that we're looking broadly.
I'm not worried.
I think we lost Janet.
So as I mentioned from our CHA this time, these are not all of the priorities, but they are one, some of the top CHA findings. And kind of to follow that conversation, Commissioner Johnson, that you had started with housing, we may take that one piece and look at it and really discuss it thoroughly through a prioritization matrix, which would, this is an example of a conversation, way of facilitating the conversation around what we can prioritize and if we have the resources available, is somebody else already working on this issue, things of that nature. And we may determine that this is not the time for public health. This is not the way in which we're going to be focusing our efforts, but we'll support in other ways through the community partners or the comprehensive plan is a perfect example of that one, for example. But there may be other ones such as senior health and supports and encouraging us to think about things that are outside of these too, where it's traditional public health services that we're actively working towards, being intentional about the efforts we're putting towards those concerns and measuring them and also monitoring and evaluating our efforts along the way.
So I'm looking at the priorities from the last CHIP and these priorities from the 2024 CHA. I'm assuming that depression and suicide would be lumped into the mental health care service availability piece. What about interpersonal abuse? Would that just drop off of the plan, do you think? Or would it?
I think that with interpersonal abuse, it would be wise of us to revisit and see what efforts are being put towards it. But also just working through if that's going to be of our priority this time around. I don't want to discourage that it's not an issue or downplay the significance of that. I'm just kind of going based off of our results from our health assessment. That wasn't necessarily something that rose up as a concern from the community, not to say it isn't an issue. So that would just be a conversation that we would need to have if we're going to focus efforts on that, or if we need to look towards other things to focus our efforts on.
And you get four priorities total. Is that the rule?
No,
to be honest, it varies greatly. Mm-hmm. Some counties have one priority. Mm-hmm. Some counties have five. I would honestly say that it would come down to our resources and our ability to address them effectively.
I would have loved to have been in the room where they got everybody to agree on one countywide priority. Holy smokes, that would have been a arm wrestle.
In the report, there are sub, you know, these ones, you know, took center stage, but there are other items called out, food security and access being one of them.
Childcare access was another.
Oh, Lord. So many things.
The partnership piece of it would be a strategic workshop. So actually, right when we started the community health assessment process, we asked partners to come to the table. Commissioner Bacon was a part of that meeting. And it was really productive just to kind of set the groundwork and understanding, baseline understanding what a community health assessment is, what the process looks like, what the community health improvement process looks like. So this would be a re-engagement of a lot of those partners. Ideally, the strategic workshop would also focus a lot on those priorities. Who are the players that we need to bring to the table when it comes to the priorities we've identified for public health? And then we kind of walk through a lot of these pieces, ideally through more engaging activities than just asking questions of folks, but really looking at more strategically at how we're going to address these issues long term. So this gives you another layer of that prioritization to see if the community's ready too. It's a big piece. And then that's when we will invite the larger community to provide input and engagement around those priorities, the input from our community partners, and just gain a deeper understanding of what the work is to come and what folks are excited about or worried about, anything along those lines. And then we share the results. So I do want to emphasize that this is a very general overview of the process. We'll be coming back to Board of Health with more specifics around dates, topics to be covered, checkpoints along the way. So this is just kind of a 101 kind of meeting for folks.
I do have, I guess, a personal thing I just got to put out here. If we're trying to pick and choose, you can just add this as a voice. So access to care, the last report show, or your you know, for the last CHIP, it showed that access to care has gotten better. And I know I get complaints all the time because it's so hard to find a doctor. You have to go across the water, blah, blah, blah. I know that. All of that's true. But we're seeing that we went from about 57.8% of people had got a routine medical checkup in 2012 to 73% now. So to me, that's showing that it's going the right direction. I personally would not like to see us just stop considering interpersonal abuse as a important thing to consider to continue to pay attention to. I'm speaking now as a person who many decades ago was a battered wife. That remains a significant piece of my personal history and for a lot of people out there. Anyway, that's a data point that continues to be important to me personally.
Thank you for that.
I think this is baggage, right? Like I've noticed the longer I've been in this job, the more baggage I bring to every conversation. So one of the things that I know that you're clear on, and I hear you say it clearly, is that we're facilitating these conversations with partners to try to get solutions out there, and the appropriate partnering agency will be the solution provider. And I hear that, and I know that you understand that, and I know we understand that. But one of the things that I felt was challenging the last time we did this is that it's the critique of not being able to succeed in some of these areas fell onto the county because we were the facilitators of conversation. So if we take the behavioral health system, for example, because I can talk about that pretty easily, agree that that system is failing. I would, and that there are significant partnerships needed to fix that. And it takes a significant amount of education to understand why and how and where and what the barriers are. And many of those don't rest with us, right? Like I'll argue the contract needs to be stronger. The healthcare authority needs to hold people accountable. We have a system that is not accountable to local government or state government on a very large scale. It's accountable to the executive branch of the state government, and it's failing. People are right to say it's failing, but then they come up with local solutions that are not implementable or not, there's not really a willingness to take a full scope to understand what the problems really are and where the barriers are. And so what they want to do is, well, we want to build something. Yep. Yeah. Yes. Me too. But we don't have a workforce. We don't have a funding stream. The way the model flows through the state agencies, we can't get enough money down to staff up. So we'll have a facility that we can't Oh, by the way, only Medicaid patients can go because the state dollars that are flowing in leaves us with a regional shortfall. And so, I mean, there are so many complexities that I worry sometimes about this process, which I am supportive of, and I'm glad it's community-based, but we end up owning it in terms of the community. And they will say, well, why haven't you, right? If I hear one more time, why haven't you built affordable housing? I literally don't know if I'll be able to self-manage my reaction to that, because I want to say we've been buying land, we've been identifying property, we're working with people, like, but we don't build things, right? And we are not the private sector, and we are not the market, and I'm not Walmart, and I didn't decide how much to pay people. And I, like, there's so many variables that aren't county controllable. And I'm just sharing this because, again, although we're clear about the role of public health in facilitating these groups and educating and encouraging, I'm not sure the public is not looking at us to be the solution to the problem. And so I just kind of want to put that out there in care of how many topics we pick that really require us to depend on other systems. We don't provide healthcare. And so access to healthcare is a challenging conversation if the Navy decides they're not going to do something and Would Be Health decides they're not going to do something. Well, what, right? We can bring attention to the problem, but we don't have control of those budgets, those right. decision makers. Childcare is another thing where people keep looking. I mean, the number of times I read what's Island County doing about childcare, we zone to allow you the opportunity to provide childcare, but we don't give you your childcare license. We don't make people go into business, and we don't have a funding resource that would subsidize childcare. So that conversation, although a countywide problem in terms of numbers, has, we have no real authority over that other than to say it can go here, or we'll suspend some codes for childcare. We could probably do that. I just want to be cautious about picking too many things that aren't achievable by work we could do, yeah. Right? I mean, I like to work with partners, but really, if we have zero ability to pull something across the finish line, even with influence, I'm not sure if it's healthy for our organization, also something I care about the health of, to carry the perceived failure when we started off the conversation with zero ability to control the outcome. Yeah. So I just want to give that as feedback. And again, I know it's baggage. I get that. But I don't know that I want to watch it happen twice.
Yeah.
That's very, very helpful feedback and welcome feedback all throughout the process, just like that. As somebody who hasn't been a part of the CHIP process from the past, it's it'll be really helpful to have that perspective along the way. Especially when thinking about the public health focused priorities and what we have, mm-hmm. what we're able to move the needle on as a public health department,
yeah.
is going to be really helpful.
I think it speaks to why one county chose one single priority. And we've had a lot of internal discussions about this very topic, and there's a lot of sync between how we've are thinking about this, because it is an opportunity as well. Like Taylor mentioned, the comp plan. So with housing, is this CHIP an opportunity to highlight and promote the work the county is doing, the work that's already taking place, but maybe we can help tell the story of this work and get it out into the community. But then when it comes to where we're leaning in as a priority, being really clear about our public health swim lane and capacity to lead and be successful, so that we're choosing a project that we can follow through on.
Thank you for hearing me out.
Absolutely. Thank you. More to come.
It's good work, and it's very well thought out and planned. So I feel like it's progressing at a slower than you want, but very organized pace.
Yeah.
Step at a time.
Yeah. And plus, now that we got you back to your focus area, you know, that's right. Hey, sorry, were you waiting for me to say food team industry meetings?
Yeah, so just a quick promotion for we have on March 10th industry meetings coming up. This is an opportunity for our food safety team to meet directly with the food industry and, you know, hear feedback, you know, workshop and troubleshoot. And so that'll be taking place from 9 to 12 on Whidbey. And then we're having a consumer meeting from 1 to 3 p.m. where is more an opportunity to the public and folks who would, you know, visit food establishments.
And what day? Oh, March 10th, 9 to 12 here?
Yes.
Will there be a Zoom option?
I believe there will. We had that last time. So I'll work with the team to make sure.
So you were speaking with Commissioner St. Clair about the potential for setting up a remote option for Camano Island as well. So I think that would be helpful for folks.
So if you could send us the link for the consumer meeting, that would be great.
And then I would just add, after the finance update, there was a quick legislative one pager on some of the priorities that WASALFO is tracking. This really whittles it down. As you know, there are so many bills in this early stage, and staff were monitoring a number of them. I can pull this up here. But if there are bills of interest to the Board of Health, staff can take a deeper dive and provide a level of, you know, bill analysis and think about, you know, local. We really have, Melissa, do you mind sharing that? It's at the end of the agenda. But we really have an eye to, you know, to local impact. A few of the, well, I won't go through, there's still quite a few even after whittling it down. So it's this document is included in your packet. We're of course available to speak to these. We have a number related to our, you know, environmental justice or environmental health work, including one bill on environmental justice, bills related to prevention and chronic disease, and that could have impact for our local communities. The tobacco and vapor products tax is on the list because that is one source of funding for foundational public health services. So it's a bill to track. And then there are a number of these, so I won't go through them in detail. But
I know a couple of these, which I just want to call out because I think it's just philosophically important. So WASAC is opposing the micro enterprise home kitchen bill, and it's opposing the water recreation facilities bill, both of which at a high level seem like something we'd be supportive of. But it puts the county in a position to go in and say, is your hot tub clean? Is your pool clean? And again, like you're thinking about VRBOs and different types of activities. Or if you have a home kitchen, we would be going into somebody's private refrigerator, maybe for some of these micro, what's that called again? Micro enterprise home kitchens. And so really the concept that I think obviously we're all concerned about public health, right? And we want people to be safe and people to be responsible. But then the other thing that we have to stop and pause as we think about any regulation is this is government going into your private home and telling you that you got to put your chicken on the bottom shelf and your cucumbers on the shelf above it. Now, I use that as an example because it's a frequent family fight with my spouse. So, but those are the types of things I know everybody knows meat on the bottom. I don't understand how this is a conversation. So, but those are the types of things when you think about the public safety standpoint, it seems like, yes, we would want government to regulate. It's also important to think about what it means to allow government the authority to go into your home. And once you grant that authority, government has it. And some governments use their authority compassionately and wisely and collaboratively. And other governments use it authoritatively and intrusively and powerfully. And so I thought WASAC was wise in looking at that and saying, one, they were saying like, we don't have staff for that. So that was just fiscal, but also saying, is that the role? Do we want to grant government that much authority? And I think it's just worth pointing out at Board of Health, because we're very health focused. And obviously, if we could wrap people in, you know, non-PFO, PFAS bubbles, we would do that, right? We would keep everybody safe. But ultimate safely guaranteed by government comes with the sacrifice of rights and freedoms. And sometimes you need to stand up for those too. And so I just wanted to bring that up as a philosophical conversation, because I thought it was important in those two areas that we don't always want government walking into your home and regulating everything that you do, that you want some personal choice and space there. So those look like they'd be bills. They say high priorities. They look like bills we would be supportive of, but WASAC's actually opposed for that, really that regulatory concern.
So it's WASALTO's position, well, as yeah. part of WASAC, and for all the reasons you outlined. And really the staffing piece is big, because we have to have someone performing this work for both the micro enterprise home kitchen bill and the water recreation facilities. So the water rec, you know, there's a lot of good language in there about kind of consolidating definitions into aquatic facilities. There's a lot of work that's outlined in there, and how that work will be performed is unclear, but those are two of our highest priority bills as a team. And so we could come back to Board of Health with some bill analysis for maybe for those, for some of the higher priority, and at least, of course, we'll continue to monitor how they progress. Another high priority bill that is the child fatalities review that would allow, when we're having this conversation about community data mm-hmm. and how we, you know, and preventable injuries. And in the past, Island County had a child fatality review board that consisted of the coroner. I believe there's representative from law enforcement. This is one way we can understand, you know, what happened and figure out what we can, you know, do better as a community. And so it's really about data and your ability to develop interventions. And so this would provide that structure to kind of bring back that process.
Do you happen to know why we stopped doing that?
I believe the funding, you know, to support that work, and I'd have to go back, and okay. I'm not sure.
Okay, no, it seems like a very responsible thing to do.
Yeah. I think this would kind of bring back the structure for it. So we'll monitor that and can take a deeper dive into this bill specifics.
Okay. Personally, as someone who has a lot of constituents who live in the woods, I am interested in this alternative on-site sewage systems
right.
piece.
Yeah, we can.
That's a medium priority, but you know, in the list of things, I guess it's not the highest priority, but it's something that I am very interested in.
Yeah, so I believe when there are poor soils or high water table, this would create a set of guidelines. It would involve rulemaking that would then require a local health officer to approve an alternative design for these sites. I'll unpack this more with the team. For us, you know, we're always working to find those solutions and yeah. get things approved. So I don't, for as far as our local impact, mm-hmm. but I'll unpack it and we'll bring that one back.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm interested. I mean, they're all good priorities or reasons that we oppose. And I think also just keeping our eye on the funding, or as you said, even about those ones where if funding's being cut, we do not have the ability to add more oversight staff to go out there and inspect more things. I mean, you either give us funding or acknowledge that you've frozen it or reduced it, and that's what you're going to do, but we can't add and suffer reductions at the same time. That's not survivable.
No. Yeah. And on the topic of funding, I mean, maybe at the next Board of Health, but I can provide updates as we receive them around public health, the funding landscape, but mm-hmm. we're really focused on FPHS advocacy right now and thinking, mm-hmm. you know, how we can tell the story of the community impact and make sure we're advocating for our funding as the budget process. Mm-hmm. But there may be a role in Board of Health in to play in advocacy. So we can bring that discussion back though for our next meeting. Think about strategies potentially.
Okay.
Excellent. I forget I'm chairing. Do we have any board member comment? Do you have all your board member comments and announcements?
I was just wondering if Dr. Librand has anything to share today.
Well, can you hear me?
Can
you hear me okay?
We hear you.
Okay. Well, it was really good to hear the calm voice of Sean again. Thanks for coming back, Sean.
Thanks for having me.
And the comment that was made, science is science. And, you know, switching issues doesn't change the fact that we need to follow science. And I think that the science that makes public health work has been in the process of developing for hundreds of years, at least that it's well recorded. And that's not going to change in 2025. Even though policies might change and funding streams might change, we still have to commit to keeping our citizens healthy. And if that requires something that is being discouraged by other people, then you know, we have some choices to make, and hopefully we'll be making some good choices. So I guess that's all I have to say.
Thank you. Anybody else? Well, we commented as we went, so I'd say we're done. We're going to adjourn. Good meeting.
Yeah.